And I'm McKenna.
And together we're the Daily Profcast.
We're two long-distance besties
who share a love of Harry Potter.
We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Welcome back to the Daily Profcast.
We are, we're glad to be back. It's been a hot minute.
A million years.
We had some, we want to thank everybody for your patience. We had some health stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, should we give a life update?
Yeah. Why don't you start?
Well, I had COVID. So we've already previously recorded this episode, but I was like very out of it when we recorded. Although Aaron says I did a much better job than I think I did.
You did. You were pretty on it. I was very impressed.
But basically the next day I was very sick from COVID and took a little trip to the hospital to get an antibody infusion and was sick for like probably a solid 2 weeks and then just really tired and then had to catch up from work, from missing work. So it's just been like a really weird couple of months. And then like you had some stuff going on too.
I had some projects for work and for some of my students and all that jazz. So McKenna was ill. I was busy. McKenna was ill and busy. And we just kind of needed a little break, but you know what, at the end of the day, we were sorry to sort of leave you guys in the lurch for a little bit, but at the same time, this is like our fun friend time. And when we set out to do this podcast, we like made it very clear with each other that this was like something we're doing for fun because we love it. And we never wanted it to be like turn into a stressful, awful thing that we like didn't look forward to. We always love like scheduling a time each week to sit down and hang out on Zoom with each other and just like talk about nerdy things.
Yeah.
And this is our fun friend time, and we never want it to become like a chore. Like, I don't want it to become a chore to see McKenna and hang out with her and talk to her.
And I think like, honestly, we probably could have sat down and recorded like a bunch of episodes in the last month or so, but it's also like the editing of the episode, putting it out, creating like Instagram and TikTok content to go with the episodes. Like, it ends up just sort of like adding more and that it's more job rather than like fun friend time. Mostly just more than anything, thank you to literally everyone who has reached out. We have dozens of DMs from friends just like concerned for us and missing us, and it's just, we are excited to be back.
Lots of TikTok comments too, and we really appreciate it, and we were sorry to leave you hanging there for a few months. We just needed a little break, but now we're back.
Yes.
So with that, thank you, McKenna. She's doing a dance now. I wish you guys could see. Since it's been a hot minute, I thought we'd just do like a very quick little recap. So the last episode, if you're caught up, which I hope you took these last couple of months to catch up if you weren't caught up.
Caught up because our listenership has actually increased. And I was really concerned
we would
decrease like severely, but we are almost coming up on a total of 100,000 listens on the podcast.
Okay,
and
our listener
base went up like about 300 people. So I guess like we've put out a lot of content. So hopefully people have just had the opportunity to catch up on what we've been doing and then just like be hooked, or maybe have gone back to listen to old episodes and like finish things that they might have not finished before. So anyways, thanks for listening. And I hope that this next episode.
Oh my gosh. Thank you, everyone, for sticking with us in our little path. Just a quick recap. If you're caught up, the last episode you would have heard was chapters 9 through 12. And I'm going to gloss over this very quickly. Chapter 9, we're coming out of the Quidditch World Cup, and there's the terror attack at the Quidditch World Cup. All this mayhem. They think Winky conjured the Dark Mark. There's this, you know, uproar at the ministry about it. And then, you know, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, and, you know, also by proxy, Ginny, Fred, and George are all off to Hogwarts. They learn about the Triwizard Tournament and how that's coming up. And then we have left off where this is, you know, they've just come from the welcome feast talking about the Triwizard Tournament. You know, Fred and George are all mad that they don't think they're going to enter because of the age limit. And then Harry falls off to sleep dreaming of being champion. Little does he know that he's going to wish he didn't. So we pick back up in chapter 13, Mad-Eye Moody. Mad-Eye Moody is one of my favorite characters, and I understand this isn't actually Mad-Eye Moody, but I just love
Mad-Eye. But Barty Crouch Jr. does deliver an Oscar-worthy performance.
I have that note in here, like, Barty Crouch Jr. should have gone, instead of to Hogwarts, he should have gone to the Wizarding Academy of Dramatic Arts, WADA, which is a thing in canon. There is a wizarding drama school. He should have gone to WADA, because the lengths he goes to convince everybody that he is actually Mad-Eye Moody is astounding. Even when we first meet him in these first couple chapters. So at the start of chapter 13, this is the trio's very first day of school, which means it's September 2nd, because in the wizarding world, apparently September 2nd is always a Monday. Makes no sense.
But it makes no sense.
But we know that the author is horrible with dates and numbers and time in general.
Yeah, she's not very consistent, is she?
No, not at all. The Hermione, after finding out that the house elves have been cooking all the food, she had a very short-lived hunger strike and is eating again, which is good. But she says she's figured something else out to, like, help free the house elves in the kitchens. They have divination with Trelawney. I think it's double divination on the first day. And what's hilarious is Trelawney is, you know, she's doing her usual, like, predicting Harry's demise. And she's sort of rambling on, looking at him going, oh, Saturn must have had great influence on your birth. Were you born sometime midwinter? And Harry has to correct her and be like, I was born July 31st. This is hilarious because Trelawney made the original prophecy talking about a boy born at the end of the seventh month, so at the end of July, and how he would come to defeat the Dark Lord. And we all know that's Harry. And like, she made that prophecy. Now, she was in a trance-like state, but I don't know if she never got a recap or what, because this is hilarious that she's messing up his birthday when she predicted that his birth in the specific time that he was born, like, he would be the one to defeat Voldemort. She's just ridiculous.
Right. Well, interesting tidbit here is that Voldemort was born on December 31st, which would be a winner.
Really?
And so, kind of just, and I'm sure this is more Trelawney just being ridiculous, but I think it's an interesting Easter egg.
Yeah. It's just funny that she would forget it. Ron makes a comment about seeing Uranus to Lavender, which is an interesting little bit of foreshadowing. And also, I'm like, shut up. Don't be a teenage boy. Don't say
boys are so.
They're growing up. He says, damn it, earlier in the chapter.
Growing up.
I'm like, oh my gosh, stop my babies.
I know. And as we're going to see in the movie, like, they look so grown up. And their hair is just.
Oh, yeah. The year that nobody cut their hair.
I know. It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Fred and George and Ron and Harry all have this, like, 70s shag. It's crazy. So still the first day of school, the trio comes down for lunch, and Malfoy's just being a little jerk. Like, I mean, what else is new? But not only is he teasing Ron about the fact that his father was in the Daily Prophet in an article by Rita Skeeter, so she inevitably got his name wrong, which might be kind of a blessing that he, you know, she didn't name him correctly. However, there's a picture of Ron's parents in the Prophet just talking about how Arthur came out during the mayhem of the Quidditch World Cup and, like, made a statement casually that was then, like, taken as a official ministry statement because he's a ministry employee. Anyway, there's a picture of Molly and Arthur in the Prophet, and Malfoy starts fat-shaming Molly. He's like, your mom could stand to lose some weight, Weasley.
You know, a lot of characters in this book just are very fat-phobic. I mean, Malfoy, obviously, I think it's making a point just about to drive home what a terrible person he is. But it is really a common theme that I think sort of unearths the author's own, like, internalized fat phobia.
And she does have internalized fat phobia. There are lots of characters that are bad that are, you know, written to be overweight. And it, like, equates fatness with badness, which, so anyway. But yeah, Malfoy's, like, he's making comments about Molly's weight. And Harry and Hermione have to, like, hold Ron back. And then Harry, you know, comes back at Malfoy and he's like, well, your mom always looks like she's like smelling something awful. Is that just because I saw her with you? And then he turns his back and Malfoy tries to curse him with his back turned. So Harry hears this bang whiz past his ear. It misses him, but he turns back around and Malfoy is nowhere to be seen. And there's Professor Moody. And then there's this white ferret on the floor. So this happens a little bit differently than in the film where we see it out in the courtyard. But yeah, so Professor Moody turns Malfoy into a ferret. It's hilarious. This is what I'm talking about. Like, Barty Crouch Jr. is fully aware that is the son of prominent Death Eater Lucius Malfoy. Like, his colleague.
Yeah, it's so funny. Do we think that if Draco had a Patronus, it would be a ferret?
I really like that headcanon. I love that. Yeah, I'm gonna stick with that. That's hilarious. I don't think we ever hear of Draco producing a Patronus, right?
No, I don't
think. Which, I mean, it's not. So contrary to popular belief, I've been doing a lot of reading about Patronus charms just in my spare time. Contrary to popular belief, the Patronus charm is not part of the Hogwarts curriculum normally. We only see it get taught at Hogwarts because Harry teaches Dumbledore's army how to conjure it and Lupin taught him. But it's not something that students learn at Hogwarts because it's a really difficult charm and most people would not have success with it.
Yeah, and I mean, God forbid they teach something useful at Hogwarts.
It's so silly. Anyway, continuing on. So Moody gets chastised by McGonagall for using transfiguration on a student as punishment, which I find funny because in a couple chapters here, Professor Snape is like threatening to poison people as punishment and then like give them an antidote. Or is it the frog? I don't know. He's threatening to poison either a student or Trevor. And I'm like, if Moody can't use transfiguration as a punishment, then Snape certainly can't poison people.
I think threatening and following through are different.
It's so bad.
Yeah, it is bad. I mean, Snape should never have been an educator. He's a terrible educator.
He's a horrible teacher.
He doesn't like children.
Yeah, he's a horrible teacher. Yeah, I've just got on my notes here, like, Barty Crouch Jr. is a damn good actor.
No, he is. It's an Oscar-winning performance.
It's the commitment. Anyway.
I think that's what makes the end of this book when we get the big reveal. I remember reading it for the first time, and it's so shocking because you really, unless you know, you don't, there's just no way you can know.
I think that absolutely, and I think the even crazier thing is, like, we are coming out of the scene at the graveyard, and then, like, Harry's already been through such trauma, and then all of a sudden there's this plot twist, like, post-final battle, and you're like...
Right, because as a reader, you just think, okay, that was it. That was the climax.
Yeah.
Now we're going to finish out the book. Harry's definitely going to leave this year happy, because typically, like, he's, like, so sad to leave Hogwarts and can't wait to return the next year.
Well, I mean, not because Cedric's dead.
Yes, exactly. Spoiler. And so now we get this another big shock. And it's kind of like the first year where you're like, oh, wow, like, what's going on? Like, Harry's, he's just, like, in this flux, you know, where it's, like, what is it going to look like coming back to Hogwarts next year? I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. But my point is, in the book, he's so good. I was about to say David Tennant, but no.
Also David Tennant.
Is so good at putting on the show to pretend to be Moody. And I just remember reading this book for the first time, and it was quite shocking.
It kind of makes me wonder if, like, because it, you know, not only is he going to such lengths to gain Harry's trust, like, this is what this is, like, he attacks Malfoy to gain Harry's trust. That's the ultimate goal right now, so that in the end he can get him alone. And but, like, he could also just, like, I don't know, poison him in his sleep. This is just, like, this is great lengths to go through just to kill somebody, or, like, lead them to somewhere where you're going to have somebody else kill them. But I wonder, like, maybe when the author figured out that's the plot twist she wanted, just because, like, Moody's, the performance is so good that, like, Moody's character, as we know it, barely changes between when it's actually Barty Crouch Jr. and when we actually meet Moody and, like, get to know him more in Order of the Phoenix. Like, his character barely changes. So either, you know, she just wrote that, like, Barty Crouch Jr. is a really good mimic and actor. Or I don't know when she came up with this idea to have this plot twist take place. I wonder.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I don't know. It's very interesting to think about.
And to be fair, like when you know that you're having an audience of people reading and you know that like you want them to be fooled, you have to fool them. So like making it this convincing is going to fool the reader until the big plot twist where we all go, oh my gosh, I never saw that coming. So this is like part of fooling your readership as well. But it's just, I just wonder. Anyway, this brings us into chapter 14. We're going to talk about Moody even more because this chapter is called Unforgivable Curses. It's about that fateful Defense Against the Dark Arts class.
This is one of the hardest chapters for me to read.
Is it?
Yeah.
Because of Neville?
Yeah. So Moody, so we open up on the kids being, you know, they're going to class. It's their first Defense Against the Dark Arts class of the year.
I believe it's a Thursday.
And, you know, they're all excited after seeing the teacher turn Malfoy, their arch nemesis, into a ferret. You know, they know that he's a dark wizard catcher. Like,
yeah, he's got this reputation that precedes him.
Right. There's this like, and there's this mystique about him, you know. So they're all very excited to be going. We find out, which I think this is so sweet, is that Lupin has basically like left a letter for the future teacher to tell them like basically where the kids left off, like what they still need to learn. It's very upsetting that this is like the only mention of Lupin in the book.
Yeah. So he writes a letter to Mad-Eye that has presumably been intercepted by Barty Crouch Jr. either before or after he starts impersonating Moody. That, you know, this is the curriculum we went over. This is probably what you're going to want to go into, which is probably completely ignored in favor of teaching unforgivable curses. But anyway, yeah, this is the only mention of Lupin. And I've always found this like lack of like Harry developed this close bond with Lupin the previous year, which would have been deepened by the like knowledge at the end of the year that Lupin was like one of his dad's best friends. And there's never a passage where Harry's like, Harry, you know, Harry wondered how Professor Lupin was doing. And like, because he had a rough end to his year and like everyone found out he was a werewolf. And so Harry decided to send him a letter to check on. Like, there's no, he like complete, the author forgot about him. So by proxy, Harry forgot about him. It's right. Like, it makes no sense. She's just like shooting herself in the foot with one of her best characters.
I did read something. And I haven't really fully checked into it, so I don't want to say if this is true or not. But I have read that after Prisoner of Azkaban, a lot of people came out sort of in support of like what we would now call Wolfstar, of this like Remus and Sirius romantic relationship, yeah. And that her and all of her internalized homophobia that presents itself externally so often, kind of decided to like write Remus out of this book. And then when there was like some fan outrage about that, she brought him back, but then pretty much like very quickly after put him into a heterosexual relationship.
Yes, I've heard that as well. Again, I don't have confirmation on that from sources, but I've heard that as well. Even so, like, I don't know. I mean, the fact that she like did that just to avoid fans like putting two characters together that they wanted to be together is like already you're like, okay.
Yeah, little did she know, less than 20 years later, people would be making TikToks about professors and students together. So
oh my gosh, stop it with the shipping adults with people under the age of consent. Need cut it out. Ships. Stop it.
Horrible. I think it really shows terrible judgment on the part of the author because Lupin is one of her best characters. Like I really like the books and I think that there's a lot of base material to work with. I think I'm more interested in what the fandom has done since the publication of the books with like the way the world has been expanded and kind of the way we've picked it all apart and thought about things. But when I actually read the books, I'm like, her quality of writing is like fine. It's not brilliant.
What the author is like really good at and what made these books captivating to the world is her world building. It's very creative. There's some Swiss cheese as it is. Right. There's a lot of holes and there's some debate as to whether she might have copied some other people's ideas. But if we're not taking that into consideration at the moment, which I mean, we should take that into consideration, but I haven't done enough research to say definite things about it. So if we're not taking that into consideration for the moment, her world building is very cool, very creative. We all got lost in Hogwarts and the wizarding world and like how cool that is.
But she you're right, had a great way of pulling you out of reality.
And the long-term storytelling was like the, you know, Harry's entire character arc, I think one could argue is pretty cool and like the way that developed over 7 books. But yeah, you're right. The like the, and keep in mind, it's a kid's book, but still the writing style is like, you know, there are things to be desired.
I think that it was just a mistake to like remove Lupin.
Absolutely.
Because he just really was like one of the more well-developed characters.
Yeah, 100% a mistake.
Yeah, she did. And people love him. Like people resonate to Lupin. There's, I think people can feel and relate to like the pain he feels and the way that he's been outcast from society. The fact that he's one of the only people left standing from his friend group, you know, even though Sirius is alive at this point, but he's basically been, it might as well have been dead for 12 years. Yeah. I don't know. He's just such a great character. Anyway, this was like a really long tangent, but
we just love Lupin. We justice for Lupin. Anyway.
So the lesson that they're walking into today is unforgivable curses.
And Moody says something really weird at the top of the lesson. He's like, I've only got 1 year to teach you this stuff. And Ron's like, why would you only have 1 year? Like he's already planning to leave. Now we all, there's this like unsaid curse on the position where anybody only holds it for a year anyway. But like, it's odd that he goes in only planning 1 year because Barty Crouch knows he's going to accomplish his goal by the end of the year.
Yes. So yeah, that's kind of a mistake on his point. I suppose you could say that maybe Mad-Eye Moody would be planning to go back into like ordering
Dark But he's King. Like been retired.
But he's been retired. So that is very interesting. And yeah. I think that it's also interesting to think about. So they're learning unforgivable curses, which by nature, unforgivable. Not exactly maybe the most appropriate information for 4th years.
We learned that you're not supposed to learn this lesson until 6th year.
Right. But I think the fact that Dumbledore has okayed this lesson, presumably, like I would think that he would be in the loop on these things, especially since Mad-Eye Moody is like,
well, he says that Dumbledore has sanctioned it. We don't really know if he has. It's, I mean, knowing Dumbledore, he probably has, but we don't know.
Well, I think that he probably has, and I think that maybe is telling of the fact that Dumbledore knows things are awry. Mm-hmm. And that maybe we are starting to like hit that pinnacle where everything's just going to sort of tumble from here. And I think, you know, a lot of stuff has happened in the last 3 years of Harry's life. And I think Dumbledore is starting to get the inkling that Voldemort is imminently coming back. And right. Dumbledore has believed that for a long time, that he just didn't disappear off the face of the world.
Totally. And what happened, the resurfacing of like Death Eaters at the Quidditch World Cup was probably a big catalyst for the decision for this lesson to go through.
Right. Plus, in the last book, Peter Pettigrew has escaped. Where would Peter Pettigrew go back to? His master.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he did.
Read about that in chapter one.
So I think Dumbledore is sort of aware, and I think that's probably why he brought Moody in, because nobody is more qualified to teach
absolutely
these students about, even if he's not even necessarily giving them the proper skills to like defend themselves, he's giving them a real life view of what is basically.
And you know what? It kind of begs the question, if Barty Crouch Jr.'s goal is to lead Harry to, you know, his death by Voldemort at the end of the year, isn't it like not advantageous to him to even make him aware of these spells and like actively teach him how to resist an Imperius curse? There is a lot of significance to the fact that it's Barty Crouch Jr. teaching these kids how to resist the Imperius curse, because he resisted we're going to learn he resisted the Imperius curse from his own father. So he's a little bit of an expert on that, as Moody would probably be anyway, but like it begs the question, like, why did Dumbledore task him with this? If so, why is he still doing it? Does that not Like, is it not to his detriment to teach Harry about these curses?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting point. When I read this chapter, I didn't get as much this is how you defend yourself as I got, like, this is what they are.
Yes. So in this lesson, it's just a demonstration. Funny that the demonstration for the Imperius curse is he starts making the spider tap dance. Remember that Ron's boggart is right. A giant spider, which spider. He made to tap dance, which is kind of, that's funny, kind of a funny callback to that on the part of the author. But yeah, it's just, it's in the next lesson, he's teaching them how to resist the curse. And Harry has a lot of success with it. So
maybe he's eyeing up the competition. He's checking to see what Harry's skills are.
That's a good explanation for that. This is just a very long way to go to kill somebody.
Oh, right. I mean, I've always thought that about this book. Like, this whole scheme is so elaborate that you're telling me that there is no other way that you could have taken Harry at all. Like, this cannot be. I don't know. It is ridiculous. I mean, I get it's all for the plot of the book, but it's truly insane.
It's a very long way to go.
So he's teaching them about the three unforgivable curses, which are the Imperius curse, the Cruise curse, and then the killing curse, Avada Kedavra. These curses are so named because they are unforgivable. Any one of them will earn you a one-way ticket to Azkaban.
Life sentence in Azkaban.
Right. So he uses these spiders or the spider to sort of like,
walk. I think there are three in here.
Yeah, there are three. To walk the students through what each of the curses do. So the Imperius curse allows you to sort of control the will of another being. Obviously that is unforgivable because you're taking away somebody's free will and you can use them to do your bidding. The Cruciatus curse would be torture. And then the killing curse, obviously, it's like an immediate death. Yeah. So he's showing the kids this, like, obviously, probably is, I mean, I couldn't imagine my teacher giving us a live demonstration of how you control, torture, and kill others. Huh. Very shocking. And then specifically when we get to the Cruciatus curse, he's torturing the spider and poor Neville Longbottom is sitting in the room watching this happen. And then, you know, for backstory, which I don't think we know at this moment, I mean, we know it because we've read it, but if you're a first time reader, you wouldn't know, is that Neville's parents were tortured. They were both Aurors, and they were tortured with the Cruciatus curse. And
to insanity.
So now they're living for life in St. Mungo's. Neville was raised by his nan. And the real like cherry on the top of this like entirely messed up situation is that Barty Crouch Jr. was one of those torturers.
Yes. It's all sorts of messed up.
It's sick. It's like sick in the head. Reading it like made me tear up, and watching the movie, this part is like, it's just, it's a real,
oh my God, Matthew effort. Lewis, like little Matthew Lewis, he was still a kid during this filming, but he does an incredible job having like acting out that like trauma response and watching this happen.
It's really important to know Neville's backstory, and it will become more important in the next book and then so on. But specifically in this moment, to understand that we're so typically focused on Harry's trauma of like losing his parents and being the chosen one and whatever. But Neville is another one of his peers who has gone through a very similar trauma, maybe arguably, I don't want to say worse, but like even potentially more brutal, because his parents, they're like, they're alive, you know, they're like touchable and seeable, but they're just not the same people that they were. And Neville was very close to being the chosen one himself. The prophecy could have just
He met the criteria.
And there's a lot of theories that like Harry was only the chosen one because Voldemort chose Harry. He could have just as easily chose Neville. And so I think it's important that we just see that like this entire generation of kids, actually, there's probably a lot of Harry's peers whose lives have been affected by the first Wizarding War.
Absolutely. Off the top, Susan Bones, mm-hmm. who would have been related to Edgar Bones, who was a member of the First Order of the Phoenix. I don't think their relationship is entirely confirmed, but it's alluded to that he's maybe an uncle. And him and his entire family, including his children and his wife, were murdered by Death Eaters. So, like, that would be something that Susan Bones would have to reckon with.
Ron's two uncles murdered Bilious by Death
Weasley.
Eaters.
Yep. Wait, what? Oh, Billius Weasley, who died of the Grim. No. Yes, Ron's two uncles, Gideon and Fabian Pruitt, also members of the First Order of the Phoenix, killed by Death Eaters.
Gideon and Fabian, GNF, George and
Fred. Yes, you. Molly named the twins for that. Yes. They were murdered by no less than 5 Death Eaters in what is described to be a brutal way. One of those people was Antonin Dolohov. We know he has his own killing curse that is different from Avada Kedavra. That's like this mysterious, but apparently it's like, you know, a lot more gruesome. Anyway, so yeah, even, you know, in the book, there's this line where Neville's the one who brings up the Cruciatus curse, which is very brave of him, considering that he sees that there are demonstrations taking place after Moody has imperioed the spider. And then there's this line, it says, Moody was looking very intently at Neville, which is so creepy because it's not Moody, it's Barty Crouch Jr.
I know.
Who is the one who tore, it's disgusting. So creepy. Yeah. Can I give a little backstory on the Unforgivable Curses for, like, the First Wizarding War?
Yeah, go for it.
So, like, as they're named, the Unforgivable Curses are considered unforgivable. The use of one normally would land you a life sentence in Azkaban. Now, when you're fighting a war against Death Eaters who have no problem using them whatsoever, but you on the side of the Aurors and the Ministry are under law not allowed to use them, that sets you at a disadvantage. So at some point during the First Wizarding War, Barty Crouch Sr., who at the time was the head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, so like the head of the Aurors, or the department that the Aurors are a part of, signed a curse to kill authorization, which allowed Aurors, and by proxy the Order of the Phoenix, to use unforgivable curses for self-defense and the defense of others during the First Wizarding War. And then the real significance with the Imperius curse, and Moody points this out to Ron when Ron brings it up, is by the end of the war, a lot of Death Eaters got off scot-free because they said, oh, I was just under the Imperius curse. I was just doing the bidding of the Death Eaters because I was under the Imperius curse, when they really weren't. They were willing participants.
Yeah, and then such
we know that Mulciber Jr., who's a Death Eater that we come to meet later, but who was a classmate of the Marauders, came to be like the Imperius curse guy in the ranks of the Death Eaters. So he just basically, he was already captured. And this might be a little bit headcanon. I might have read this and thought it was canon, so don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure he like allowed for a lot of people to get off because he was like, yep, I Imperius them. I Imperius them. I Imperius them. So yeah, so that's why Moody's like, oh yeah, you would know that one. Your dad would know that one, Ron, because it gave the Ministry a lot of grief at the end of the First Wizarding War, which is why we're still having this conflict, because they didn't incarcerate the perpetrators.
Right.
And Voldemort, but like, you know.
I would say mostly the perpetrators. I mean, and that is because a lot of them, most of them, are the most privileged echelon of wizarding society. And so again, when we think about how this story relates so much to what we live in our like very human experiences in 2021, I mean, it's pretty common that if you have a lot of money and you're white specifically, it's very easy to not go to jail for the crimes that you commit. Like, we can look at the 2008 crisis.
Statistically, not as easy as it would be if you weren't white and
exactly
very rich.
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is look at the 2008 financial crisis and see all the people who are responsible for causing that and the very few of them who served any substantial time in prison. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's very similar to what they're going through in the wizarding world, where the people like the Malfoys and the Blacks and the Crouches, like, they get to get off a lot easier because One, they can lie and say, oh, I was under the Imperius curse. And two, they're seen as needed in the wizarding world, right? It's a very kind of like closed community.
Yeah, you just with pure blood.
Right. Whose money is in Gringotts? Like, who are these like pure blood families that have kept the lineages?
Yeah.
Yes. Who's on the governing board of Hogwarts? Like, you don't really have to look too far to see that where the power is and where the abuses of power are, like, pretty much match up in this world. The Malfoy is literally the most perfect example of that period.
Yeah. Yeah. We saw it a couple chapters ago. Draco was like bragging. They're like, he's like, oh, my father made a huge donation to St. Mungo's, and that's why we get to go to the Quidditch World Cup and sit with the minister.
Right.
Lucius Malfoy like went on trial for being a Death Eater, not, you know, 13 years prior.
Right. In the second book, we literally see him selling dark artifacts at Borgin and Burke's, like, and everybody knows it. Like, Arthur Weasley just knows, but there's so little he can do because of like his place in the ministry versus Lucius's place in the ministry.
Lucius doesn't even work at the ministry. He's just well connected.
Yeah. It's so truly kind of asinine and insane, but it is an unfortunate reflector of like actual reality.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so we come to our third and final curse, and Mad-Eye Moody whips out Avada Kedavra and kills the spider in front of all the kids, and he mentions only one person has ever survived this curse, and he's sitting in this room. I think I might have taken the movie line instead of what's actually written in the book, but I digress. The sentiment remains the same. Harry Potter is the only person who has ever survived the killing curse,
right, that we know of.
So.
And this is the first time where Harry, outside of his like memory and his dreams, is seeing this play out in front of him. And unfortunately, not the last time in this book.
Yep. Speaking of his dreams, at the end of this chapter, he hears back from Sirius. Finally, he sent him a letter before he went off to the Weasleys for a couple weeks, and then didn't hear back from him, and was really worried that Sirius had gotten captured. So this tropical bird comes. So Sirius is like, I don't know, South America, Africa, I don't know, he's somewhere south.
Brazil.
I like to think of him on a beach enjoying himself and like having a good time after 12 years of hell. But he's somewhere nice with tropical birds, and he basically sends a letter back. He's like, oh, that's kind of troubling that you told me your scar was hurting and that there's this like tournament going on at school. Oh, actually, Harry wouldn't have written about the tournament because he didn't know about it yet at the time of the letter. Never mind. It's kind of troubling that your scar was hurting. I'm going to come back to England and Scotland. And Harry immediately backpedals. He's like, just kidding. It was fine. False alarm. Don't come back, because he's really terrified of Sirius, his only family. Really, at this point, not counting the Dursleys, because why would we count the Dursleys, is, you know, still on the run from the law. This brings us into chapter 15, Beauxbatons and Durmstrang. At the top of the chapter, Harry writes a response and is like, no, please don't come back. It's fine.
Right, because he doesn't want Sirius to get caught, and then he has to live with that guilt because, like, he finally has a person.
Yeah, very short. Anyway, so in this chapter, they have another Defense Against the Dark Arts class where Moody is physically teaching them to resist the Imperius curse. And Harry's really good at it. He's really good at it. He gets it on the first try, and then he continues to like get it. So the Imperius curse can be resisted if you have there's always a caveat for this stuff, right? So the caveat for the Imperius curse is it can be resisted if you have a really strong will. So Harry's able to resist it. It's like the same thing with Veritaserum. People are like, why didn't they give Sirius Veritaserum to see if he was lying about, you know, being the secret keeper for the Potters and turning them over to Voldemort? Well, Veritaserum isn't perfect either. If you know it's being administered and you have a strong will as well, you can like power through Veritaserum too. So there's always a caveat, but they're learning how to resist Imperio. And Mad-Eye Moody's just like performing that curse on students. He's not doing anything. It's pretty benign. He's like asking them to jump on tables. He's not doing anything horrible, but like, it's still, that's really creepy. And by this point, Hermione has started forming SPEW, the Society for the Protection of Elvish Welfare. Is that correct?
Yep.
And she's made buttons. She's like getting this whole club underway where she is going to free the house elves out of the kitchens. And I just love her little advocate heart.
Yes, she's such an Enneagram one.
She's an Enneagram one. Ready for the promotion of elvish welfare. Yes, forgive me. It was going to be stop the outrageous abuse of our fellow magical creatures and campaign for a change in their legal status, but it wouldn't fit. It's funny to me because I was skimming back over these chapters before we recorded today, and she treats the blast-ended scroots in Care of Magical Creatures with such disdain. She's like, we should step on all of them. Like, Hermione, dude. Like, and I mean, I understand that maybe the scroots aren't as, like, sentient and humanoid as the house elves, but I'm like, oh, okay, that's different. Anyway.
Chapter 15?
Yes, we're in chapter 15. Yeah. We are coming up on Halloween when the other schools are supposed to arrive. Sirius writes back to Harry again and is like, nice try. I'm coming back anyway. So now Harry's freaking out about that. And Ron and Harry are giving Hermione some grief about SPEW. I would think that Harry would care more about SPEW because of relationship with Dobby. But he's kind of going along with it for Hermione, but he doesn't like care.
No, he's not very
interested. I would think he would be a little bit more interested because of what he experienced with Dobby.
I'm not sure that he's so much concerned about the plight of Dobby and House Elves so much as he was concerned with sticking it to the Malfoys when he freed Dobby.
Yeah. Or like just specifically Dobby's plight.
Yeah. And he's like a punk kid right now, you know?
He's, what is he, 14 now?
Yeah, he's starting to care about girls.
Yeah, he's 14 now.
And he also, like, has the imminent battle against the Dark Lord on his mind, I think, so.
Well, he doesn't know that yet.
I mean, don't you think it weighs on Harry, like?
Well, his scar has been hurting. He knows something's weird.
Yeah, something's up.
Yeah. So the day comes when the other schools participating in the Triwizard Tournament are set to arrive. This is my favorite thing. I always forget, because we don't see them in the films, I always forget about their like hats in their uniform, their little pointy black hats. So they all file out onto the front of the school in their pointy black hats. This is funny because people criticize the author about not making enough references to it being the 1990s in these books, which like I agree. There's like not enough like culture references, even though we know the wizarding world is pretty separate from the Muggle world. But there is one mention in here that people love to bring up, and it's the fact that Parvati Patil is wearing a butterfly clip in her hair, which is
very 90s. Yeah.
And then our friends from Beauxbatons and Durmstrang arrive. So the people from Beauxbatons arrive in a giant carriage with giant horses and their giant headmistress, Madame Maxime.
Yeah. And so I don't want to like spend too much time on this, but in the movies it is displayed that these are like girls' school and boys' school, Beauxbatons girls, Durmstrang boys. That's not really reality.
Not in the book series.
That's not canon to the book. So the book, they're both mixed schools, which doesn't make sense because it's like one wizarding school for a region. So it just like wouldn't, like that just doesn't make sense.
No, yeah. So they are co-ed in the books. There's a mention of at least one male student at Beauxbatons and at one female student from Durmstrang there present. And we know that the entire student body of those schools is not here. It's right. Just the people like of age who are going to be eligible for the Triwizard Tournament.
And so I Fleur's think, sister.
And Fleur's, yeah, weirdly also Fleur's sister because they couldn't be separated or something.
Yeah, I would think that it's like the top pupils who are eligible have come.
There are like 8 to 12 people for Beauxbatons and for Durmstrang, apparently.
I also like headcanon that likely they probably did some sort of trial at the school to qualify those hands.
You don't think the headmasters just like handpicked who they wanted to come?
Maybe, but
certainly maybe Karkaroff.
Yeah, maybe Karkaroff. But I mean, I would think that there's probably some sort of like qualifier as to why those people come. So yeah, so like you said, they arrive with the carriages and the giant horses.
And then Durmstrang
arrives on a boat.
On a boat on the lake. Big old boat. There's a little bit of a weirdness here when Durmstrang arrives for a couple reasons. So number one is recognized walking through the crowd is none other than Quidditch star seeker Victor Krum.
Right.
Who is like, is this guy a super senior? Because like he's 18, or does Durmstrang go for longer than Hogwarts? Didn't they say he was 18? like a couple chapters ago at the Quidditch World Cup.
Okay, so we got a comment from somebody on Instagram who, when we talked about this in a previous episode, they were not super pleased with us because we said that we felt it may be a little predatory, the relationship between Crumb and Hermione. And this listener wanted to say that Crumb is really 17. Hermione is
14,
going on 15. And that there's, you know, they're only 2 to 3 years apart. That is not predatory. And that plenty of times people meet their husbands with that gap or their future spouses. I don't want to say husbands.
To be fair, the way the relationship plays out in the books is fairly benign.
Right. Where I am, how I responded to this listener, where I'm coming from, why I think this relationship is potentially predatory is because Victor Crumb is not like a normal 17-year-old. He's, you know what I mean? He's not like your next door neighbor, Victor Crumb. He's this international sports superstar who has a lot of influence and presumably money and power. And so with that, like, it's just, you have to recognize that there is like a power dynamic at play, that he can really probably get many of the girls that he would want to be in a relationship with or have relations with, because he carries this influence. You know, Hermione's a very smart girl and she sort of has her head very well on her shoulders. And I think that's why he takes a liking to her, because she doesn't just like follow him around and fawn over him. But
right. And there's no mention of him being anything other than, you know, polite and a perfect gentleman. However, you know, here in the US, the age of consent is 18. So, and I'm pretty sure it mentioned earlier in the book that Crumb is 18. So
I think it mentions earlier in the book that he's 17.
Is it 17? Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll have to go back and check. But anyway, so if that's the case, then legally, at least in the US, it's viewed as being okay. But that's still like, think about how you were freshman year of high school versus senior year of high school. And I know there are freshmen that date seniors. And again, like, I know that people meet their future spouses and their high school sweethearts, and there's that age gap. I was
a freshman who dated a senior. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I thought it was very
okay. I dated nobody.
At the time, I thought it was very okay. And looking back with a much more discerning adult, I can see all the ways in which I was not ready to cope with that relationship because of just the sheer maturity factor. Yeah. So yes, while I think there are people in the world who are mature enough to handle that relationship and they meet their future spouse and everything is magical, I do also just think we have to talk about the fact that like Crumb is not your average 17-year-old.
And purely based on logistics, this relationship can be seen as problematic. Not based on behavior, but based on logistics.
Right. It's just like, it's a very sort of like odd way to like dip Hermione into the proverbial shallow end of dating, you know?
And like, you know, when I was a kid reading this, I was like, this is cool for Hermione, who's so often like put down for being the sort of smart mom friend who's like, you know, momming the boys around. And then she gets like, she like gets the guy that everyone wants. That's really cool for Hermione. Like, that's what I thought when I was first reading this. And now as I'm an adult, I'm like, have you lost your mind? Because I'll help you find it. Like Stanley in The Office.
There's something so magical when you first read this and then watch it on the film of Hermione having her like Cinderella moment where she mm-hmm. comes out for the
Yule Ball. Oh, and it's a moment. She looks so good. Yes. Way to go, Emma Watson.
My issue is that moment is attached to him. Hmm. It's like, oh my God, she got to be a fairy princess and she gets to go to the ball with the prince. And I think it discounts like that Hermione's strength. Yeah, she's very beautiful. And Emma Watson is a very beautiful woman who played Hermione. Hermione's strength comes from how smart she is and determined and loyal and what a loving friend she is to Harry and Ron and to everybody around her and how she fights for the greater good of all people.
Yeah.
And I thought the movie did such a disservice. I know you can only fit so much into 3 hours, but in that 3 hours, we see Hermione have this massive Cinderella moment. She has this little thing with Victor Crumb, but we never see her like have spew or and her smarts is still often so much seen as like an annoyance rather than a gift.
Totally.
And it's not to like really Harry needs her in like life or death situations where he's like, oh my God, thank God you were here, Hermione.
Yeah.
And thank God you're the only one of the three of us who pays attention in school.
Yeah, exactly. The other weirdness with Durmstrang arriving is Igor Karkaroff. There's some like tension and baggage there. So Igor Karkaroff is a former Death Eater turned headmaster at Durmstrang, which we know that Durmstrang is a little bit more liberal in their education on the dark arts.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that they're like an evil school or
they're breeding Death Eaters, but they pose less restrictions on what the students are taught in terms of dark magic. Like, totally. I like to think about it like their restricted section of the library, probably not so restricted.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of a plot hole. In the film, you know, the actor who plays Karkaroff walks in and he's got this like thick sort of Slavic, reminiscent of Slavic accent.
It's in Finland.
Yeah, it's like in Northern Europe.
This school, we don't have a precise location, but it is likely in Norway, Sweden, or Finland.
Right, that's so, and yeah, and then in the movie, they sort of run with the Slavic thing, which
they're like so like Russian in the movie.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about all the different wizardings.
Which also really shows like the attitude. Like, do you ever notice that like in every movie, like the bad guys or like the creepy guys are like always Russian?
Yeah, that is kind of a trope in American media for sure.
Because like the rest of the world does not have like.
Not that Harry Potter is American media, but that's something that we are used to.
It's like a very Western view that like Russia is like not, you know, necessarily not. And don't get me wrong, like, from my point of view, like there's a lot of things Russian government does that like you're not so swimming, but
yeah, I mean, same with America, but we just, you know, there are historical tensions. There are historical tensions, right.
But I just think it's interesting that like this school is like, this is Scandinavian, but all of a sudden we've like created these people as Russian,
right? So okay, but keep in mind, like, Karkaroff is a Slavic surname.
Yes.
So there's this question, and he walks in and he goes, "Dear old Hogwarts," and there's no mention of him having, in the book at least, an accent. It's like we never actually get a mention in the book of Lupin having scars on his face or Harry noticing that he has scars on his face. Normally Harry notices when people have scars. Well, normally Harry notices when people have accents. Yes. And comments upon it. He doesn't comment upon Karkaroff having an accent. So, you know, you could make an argument that maybe
he went to school at Hogwarts.
Maybe he went to school at Hogwarts. He seems to have memories of Hogwarts. He fell in with the Death Eaters, which were like very much a thing in the UK because Tom Riddle went to Hogwarts and like was from the United Kingdom. But his surname may suggest Russian heritage, and there is a Russian school. So like, did he go to Hogwarts? Did he go to Koldovsteretz? Did he go to Durmstrang? Like, there's sort of a lack of knowledge about Karkaroff.
Yeah, I mean, my like headcanon for Karkaroff is that he probably went to Hogwarts and he was probably very gifted at what he did. And because Durmstrang takes a much more liberal approach to the teaching of dark arts, they didn't see him being a former Death Eater as necessarily like a disqualifying attribute of a teacher or a headmaster.
And, right. And that's probably, and I think maybe Malfoy says this, so I don't know if it's actually true, but I think they say something about how like Durmstrang only takes pure blood students. I don't actually know. We have not gotten that confirmed or denied yet.
Yeah. I take everything Malfoy says with like a tiny, tiny little grain of salt.
I take it with like a honking couple tablespoons of salt.
Yeah. Because like he just creates this like internal narrative that like pureblood is best and that his daddy is, you know, where the situation is. So yes. I also get the feeling that Karkaroff went to Hogwarts and or has just like very deep-seated memories. And his interaction with Dumbledore is very interesting.
Familiar. So I wonder, because the other thing we have to keep in mind is there is a mention in canon that like, while the first Wizarding War, like that conflict didn't really expand outside of the United Kingdom, Voldemort had like gone and done some recruiting in other countries. He had a massive following of Death Eaters. It was not just people from the UK and Ireland. Like he recruited from other countries. So I wonder if like maybe Karkaroff was a recruit on like a little recruiting trip that Voldemort did early in the years, like when he was forming his forces for the war. But then how does he like know Hogwarts? Did Dumbledore ever invite him for tea just to hang out, headmaster? Like, what is the situation here?
I all yeah, because he's like, well, in the movie, I just he's like, oh, but yeah. It's very friendly. I also wonder if there's a possibility that because young Voldemort was so interested in the dark arts and there was such a limited teaching available at Hogwarts that perhaps he traveled to Durmstrang after.
Well, we know he traveled. He did some traveling in Albania, so it's not, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that he traveled other places.
Right. Something because Durmstrang is more liberal with the teaching of dark arts, perhaps he went there to like study amongst professors there or the headmaster and gain some skills and then perhaps like pick Karkaroff up along the way.
Maybe. Yeah.
No idea.
We don't know anything. So like anything goes.
Whatever the thing is, it's familiar.
Shall we talk a little bit about the other wizarding schools? Like a brief...
Yeah, we can. I think I want to do like a whole dedicated episode to like other wizarding schools.
Oh, okay. I love that idea. Then I'll just give like a SparkNotes version.
Love that.
There are 8 other wizarding schools. So the 3 we know of, and this is also, keep in mind, this is our first time learning that there are other wizarding schools outside of Hogwarts.
Right, because of course we're in Harry's perspective, and this is the first time Harry's learning about it too. So.
But it makes sense that like, if there are all these wizards and there aren't only English and Scottish and Irish wizards, like you're like they don't only exist in like the British Isles, they're like probably elsewhere. So according to the canon that the author has created, there are 8 wizarding schools. The 3 we know of currently: Hogwarts, Beauxbatons, which is in the Pyrenees Mountains in France, and they take I had this question the last time we recorded, but it has been answered by the Harry Potter wiki. They take students from France, Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Belgium. Okay. Then there is Durmstrang. It's in Scandinavia somewhere, the northmost regions of either Norway or Sweden. The location of Durmstrang is sort of a secret, weirdly. And their range of students, it says willing to accept international students, but presumably mainly Northern and Eastern Europe. Then these other schools that we have not heard of yet and don't actually ever hear of in the books. This was like a post-series thing that the author came out with. Castelo Bruxo, which is in the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. And they take wizarding students from all over South America. Hogwarts, we know of in the Highlands of Scotland. Ilvermorny School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, which is on Mount Greylock in the United States. And they take wizards and witches from all over North America. Koldovsteretz, which is a school in Russia. They take students from Russia, from which is in Japan, and they take students from Japan. And the Wagadu School of Magic in Uganda, Mountains of the Moon, and they take students from all over Africa. So what I'm reading here is that if you are a witch or wizard born in China or like Italy, you don't get to go to wizarding school.
Maybe you could get special dispensation.
Probably. I like it's, you know, you could probably say that maybe there are some Chinese students that go to Koldovsteretz because of proximity, or I don't know. I have lots of questions about all this lore. I won't answer them all right now, but I'll just pose them for people to think about. Is there a standard language at a school like Beauxbatons where the students are from a bunch of different countries that speak a bunch of different languages? And like, what's the student body number? Like, what is the wizarding population number in all these places? Therefore, how many students go to these schools? I just have a lot of questions.
Is there like a, not like a college board, but like some sort, yeah, I'm going to say a college board.
Like an international wizarding board that creates standards for all these places. Do they have to take the ACT?
Yeah, but is there some sort of standardized curriculum? Like, do they all have to teach roughly the same things? Is there like it a seems like they're board pretty... of headmasters who meet regularly?
Like... You wonder, like, is that how Dumbledore and Karkaroff have met, outside of a trial in a courtroom? Do all the headmasters get together and play squash? Like, what's happening? I just have a lot of questions. But there are, yeah, those are your 8 wizarding schools. This brings us into chapter 16, Goblet of Fire. They learn of all the details of the Triwizard tournament in this chapter. So Dumbledore's like, we're doing this tournament. There will be a champion from each school. They have to be over the age of 17. And you put your name in this goblet. And by the end of the week, we will select the 3 champions from the goblet. Barty Crouch Sr. is there to talk about the competition, as is Ludo Bagman. That's somebody we don't see in any of the films. So, but he's there as well because he's head of magical games and sports. And everyone's just really excited about this tournament. It seems like it's going to be a really fun, you know.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to be great.
collegiate, not collegiate.
It seems like definitely nobody's going to die.
You would think. And they say like these tasks are life threatening, but if they're allowing it, it's got to be fine, right?
Yeah.
I mean, need to make a note about the Triwizard Tournament. Sorry to all of you TikTok people who make POVs about going to the Yule Ball in any year other than 1994. I think they're very cute. Please continue to make them. Just know, in canon, the Triwizard Tournament stopped being mounted by any of these wizarding schools in 1792 because too many kids were dying and they stopped the tournament for 200 years. Right. And now in 1994, they've just decided to bring it back. You look very cute.
Thanks.
Karkaroff is like a big old helicopter mom.
Oh my God. He is the worst with
He's Krum. Waiting on Victor Krum hand, like for his smallest desire. Victor's like, I have a slight head cold. And Karkaroff's like, straight to bed, anything you want. And then this other student's like, hey, I want something. And Karkaroff's like, shove off. Like, he's like paying no attention to anybody but Krum. He's a helicopter mom. And he has this weird reaction to seeing Mad-Eye Moody.
Yes, he does.
Because Mad-Eye Moody's probably the one that
put him in jail.
Yeah, put him in Azkaban for a time. He got out.
Little does he know, he could have a whole Death Eater reunion.
With who's actually in Mad-Eye Moody's body. But he has this weird reaction to him, as I would if you were like, you know, a criminal trying to get, because like Karkaroff, there's no mention that he's like not trying to get his life together. Like he seems like he's reformed.
Yeah.
You know, ish. To the point where he's like, you know, responsible enough to take care of children.
I think he is. He doesn't go back to Death Eatering, does he?
No, he doesn't.
Go back to Death Eatering.
But so he sees the guy who like probably put him in jail, and that's kind of a weird moment. And there's a little bit of tension there. And then just throughout the week, there's this like hubbub about everyone submitting to be champion. All the Gryffindors are rooting for Angelina Johnson, who
would have been an amazing champion.
Would have been an amazing champion. And right. Like Cedric is a very qualified, he makes a great champion. We love Angelina. Cedric here, but Angelina would have been such a cool champion.
Agree.
Black girl magic champion for Hogwarts for the Triwizard Tournament.
She's and she probably
was a badass.
Yeah.
Anyway. So yeah, so all the Gryffindors are rooting for Angelina. The Slytherins are trying to put forth, who is it? Is it one of the Quidditch people?
Probably Adrian.
Adrian, who?
The person.
I'm going to find it. But the Slytherins are trying to put forth a champion, and they're like all at lunch one day, and they're basically like, we can't have a Slytherin champion. Like, the Slytherins can't represent us, which I'm like, okay, come on, guys. Like,
Slytherin are people too.
Yeah, exactly. Now, again, have to mention this generation. Now, for storytelling purposes, we know that the author sort of made all the Slytherins just like
bad,
either bad or like bad leaning, permissive of the bad. But it also does make sense with this generation of like who most of their parents were. But still, it's like, you know, a Slytherin can't be our champion. I'm like, dude, come on. I don't know who it is. I think it's one of the Quidditch players, but they're talking about a Slytherin going out for champion. Anyway. Then the champions get chosen at the end of the week, and we have Fleur Delacour for Beauxbatons. Why I was so upset that in the film they made Beauxbatons an all-female school is that if that's the case, then Fleur is just the best champion out of the girls. Whereas if the school's co-ed, she is the best champion among the men and women.
She gets so robbed.
Fleur gets absolutely massacred as a character, especially in the next book.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, to be honest, in the whole book, it's yeah. Not just...
But Fleur gets chosen for Beauxbatons. Victor Krum gets chosen for Durmstrang. And Cedric Diggory gets chosen for Hogwarts. And everybody's like, great, cool, awesome. And then all of a sudden, the goblet spits out a fourth name. You're only supposed to have one champion per school. Poor Harry. And Harry gets chosen as the fourth champion. Yes.
He was so looking forward to just like enjoying the tournament and like hanging out.
And like he was like dreaming of being champion. He's like, wouldn't that be cool to be champion? But like he doesn't, you know, Fred and George go to the lengths of like trying to take an aging potion to get past the age line that Dumbledore has put around the Goblet of Fire. Harry's not like that desperate to be champion. No. He's like, oh man, can't do it because I'm not 17. Okay, I guess I'll just watch. And yeah, I think he was probably looking forward to having like a nice year spectating, and that just does not happen. Poor kid. So those are chapters 13 through 16. Next time we will go over 17 through 20.
17, 18, 19, 20. Yep.
We're cruising along. Thanks for your patience. We're back now.
We are back. And maybe some big things will happen this year with the podcast.
I'm putting that energy out for us.
We've talked a lot about potentially starting a Patreon and doing like some Patreon specific content. So if that's something you're interested in, yeah, let us know. We obviously would price it fairly and, you know, but I want to put some feelers to our listener base to tell us, like, what do you...
We were also considering in this, I don't know if this is a little ambitious, like, does anybody want a tote bag that says the Daily Profcast or like a coffee mug or like a little, or a sweat, like a little crew neck? Like, should we make, is that something that people are interested in? You could say no, but like, let us know.
Yeah,
we're making this up as we go. So
yeah, we pretty much are. So you guys love to kind of hit us up in our Instagram DMs. So if either of those things are interesting, you should let us know. And we did also toy with the film episode of this podcast doing a live recording. So you could watch us via YouTube, record the podcast sort of like in real time. We'll save a section to interact with us in chat, but then we would still post it to the feed as normal. So just like more of an interactive sitch.
Yeah.
I don't know. We're just thinking of ideas, but I am. So in my sickness, and my husband, he traveled for 2 weeks, not obviously while we had COVID, but I decided to watch all of the Marvel movies.
Oh yeah. McKenna and I, yeah. Update, personal update. McKenna and I are on like a huge Marvel kick now.
Yeah. It's McKenna, all I think about all day.
This is your first time watching all these movies.
I'm so addicted.
I'm doing a rewatch and I'm re-addicted.
I'm actually going to rewatch them again. Probably not like Iron Man 1 and 2, the original Captain America or the Hulk. I think I'll skip on those.
The ensemble movies.
Yeah, I think starting at like, I'll probably skip Iron Man 3 too. I'm going to be honest, like Tony Stark like really irritates me. He's great. He's great in a crew, but he's too much alone.
Okay.
That's where I net out on that situation. So I think I want to rewatch them all again. I definitely want to rewatch Infinity War and Endgame. I just watched Endgame on Friday.
Have you gotten to, so that's a whole bucket of tears. Have you gotten to start The Falcon and the Winter Soldier?
Oh, I will be finishing the last episode.
Oh, have fun. It's very good.
I'm just so thrilled. Sam is one of my favorite characters. Bucky is probably like my definite favorite character. And I read that there's probably going to be a season 2, which I'm really thrilled about. So I was reading, like, because Disney's obviously so secretive about all the Marvel stuff, about basically anything they do. I work for Disney, and it's like, you sign, like, ridiculous NDAs to work there. But they submitted both WandaVision and Falcon and the Winter Soldier for Emmys. But they submitted WandaVision under the category of limited engagement series. And they submitted Falcon the Winter Soldier under the like
multi-season.
Yeah. Like the regular running TV show series, which kind of the article I was reading with the critic was saying that's probably a good indication that they're not going to have WandaVision's season 2, that they might like wrap that up in the next few Doctor Strange movies or like a feature film of her own. But with Falcon the Winter Soldier, like we will likely get a second season. Plus there's Captain America 4 in the works, which will tie in with them.
Right. I love WandaVision. I think it's fabulous, but that does sort of make sense with what the plot was that it, you know, with the allusions to the sitcoms, like she's not going to do that, like again. Do the hex again, you know, so it does make sense. And yeah, she's actually the first. So by default, my absolute favorite person in the MCU is Doctor Strange.
Cumbertoast.
Because I love Eggs Benedict Cumbertoast. You can't even say his name.
Cumbertoast.
He's my favorite actor. But she is Elizabeth Olsen is the first person listed on the cast for Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness.
Oh yeah, they're for sure. She's for sure. And I've also heard that Agatha, Catherine Hahn Marcus, will be in that movie. That they're going to, and the Vision is going to be in that movie, Paul Bettany as well. So my ultimate goal, I think, is that they wrap up Wanda and Vision in Doctor Strange 2. Mm-hmm. And that like somehow Vision can come back and like him and Wanda can just go live like a normal life somewhere.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Like that's like it's like my ultimate goal for the two of them is that they find a way to like
Vision is out there somewhere with all of Vision's normal memories and stuff.
Yes. So, yes. Like, in some way, they just have to end up together. Like, I just have to believe that, like, Marvel has crushed my soul in so many ways. I probably cried for, like, 30 minutes after Endgame.
Wanda has gone through it. In all of
this. The worst part was, if you haven't watched Marvel, this is like a pretty good time to click off. But if you
bye.
The what's truly soul-wrenching for me about Wanda is that she spent all of Infinity War, like they spent all of that movie trying to find a way to like save Vision so that Vision could be with Wanda but not hold the Mind Stone. Mm-hmm. And then she has to like, okay, then they're like, okay, well, it's time to kill Vision, Wanda. And she doesn't just do it right away. Like, it takes her time to like process and like come to terms with doing it. And then she does it. And we're like, God, that was sad, but like, good for you, Wanda, for like sacrificing personal love for the good of the universe. And then stupid Thanos is just like, just kidding. Like, let's rewind and let's do it again. And this time, like, I'm taking this.
And then let's make a series and do it all over again.
Right. And then she's finally happy.
Here's what I'm gleaning from this conversation. So, guys, we need you to let us know a couple things in our DMs. We need you to let us know if you want to see some merch and a Patreon. We also need you to let us know if you would be interested in like a couple just like for funsies episodes where we talk about Marvel and not Harry Potter, just because that's something we're like hyper fixating on right now and we think it'd be fun.
Yeah, we could totally do. Or I was also thinking, like, if we started the Patreon, like, we could do a specific Marvel series on the Patreon.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be as extensive as we're doing. Like, we are not rich enough to go buy all the comics.
We're not going to read the comics, but we could just kind of talk through the movies and the series and, like, just, our thoughts about... Because the Marvel Universe, just in the movies alone, is so huge. There's so much to work with. And that's why I'm going to rewatch everything, is because I'm not even sure I comprehend everything. And what's really interesting about Marvel is that it's sorcerers, or what is Bucky saying?
The big three.
Wizards aren't real.
Robots, aliens, and wizards. Gandalf in 1937 when The Hobbit came out.
Wizards aren't real. They're sorcerers.
But let us know if that's something you guys would be interested in.
Right. I think it'd be so fun. And I can't wait for the Loki series.
Oh, yeah, me too.
When I said Bucky is my favorite, I would probably put him as like a slight under Loki.
You love morally gray characters.
Oh, gosh, he's just so funny.
You love morally gray characters, and I love like narcissists.
To me, truly, like, even before they made the tone shift in Ragnarok of Thor, where they took like Chris Hemsworth from like very serious and valiant and blah 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 to like hilariously funny, him and Loki have always just had like him and which is just so fun to watch. So like, they really kicked it up in Ragnarok. I've watched Ragnarok 3 times because it's so just delightful. It's so funny, and I just love when they're in the elevator and he's like, I don't want to do Get Help. It's so demeaning.
We're doing it. Their chemistry is awesome.
So let us know if you want us here to talk about Marvel more, because obviously I can just keep going. I'm going to go finish.
We're going to do it anyway. So we're going to do it anyway between us. So if you want it recorded, just drop us a line.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to go feed my foster kittens, take my dog for a walk, heat up some Thai food, and watch the last episode of
Winter Have Soldier. So much fun with that. I expect you to send me texts about it.
Oh, I'm sure I'm going to flip.
You are. It's so good. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sticking around during our hiatus, and we'll see you next week with some more chapters.
See you next week. Peace and love. Goodbye. Dur. Hey, thanks for listening to our latest episode. As always, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And if you're not a listener on Apple Podcasts, it would still help us out a lot if you head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about anything you heard in this episode today, please drop us a line at our Anchor profile. You can leave us a nifty little voice message there, or you can head to our Instagram @thedailyprofcast to DM us or leave us an email.